This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, The Orphans of Romania. Thousands of babies are abandoned by their mothers every year.
They don't have money, don't have nothing, and they have enough children at home, and they can't take them.
Plus, the latest from Kenya. We speak to a Nairobi blogger about the post-election violence.
The violence, the tension has moved on from being just a reaction to the election results. It's grown into something a lot bigger.
And the high cost of the big chill, struggling to keep warm in Maine.
At night, I would imagine it gets in the low 40s in here. And it's ridiculous. Why should someone have to live like that in their own house?
All that and more coming up on the World Vision Report. Romania has just entered the European Union, but its membership comes with a number of conditions. One of them is that the nation clean up widespread corruption. Another is that it stop institutionalizing children. In the 1980s, Romania warehoused 100,000 children in orphanages. Though there have been some reforms to meet the EU's demands, there's still much to be done. I visited the country to investigate the current conditions for children. You don't have to go far in this city to see that Romania's troubled relationship with its children has not been solved. It's simply shifted. This is the Panay Serbu Maternity Hospital, one of hundreds of hospitals in Romania dedicated to newborns and their mothers. This brightly lit room is filled with tiny bassinets. They're lined up neatly in rows. The baby's mothers are noticeably absent. Many of them simply had their babies and left.
How can a mother just leave a baby here?
Easily.
Doña Penchingana is the head nurse on this ward.
The mother has the baby, and she says what when she walks out the door?
Do everything you want.
Do anything you want with the baby?
Yes.
She doesn't care?
No.
She come back to see the baby?
No. No.
She's just finished?
I'm working here for 30 years, and I don't know if one or two mothers came back to ask what happened with their babies.
This is Romania's dirty little secret. Thousands of babies abandoned in maternity hospitals every year. Government social workers like Gabby, who asked that we not use her last name, blame the problem on pervasive poverty.
They don't have money, don't have nothing, and they have enough children at home, and they can't take them.
Gabby says social workers can't force the mothers to take their babies home.
She can let the child here, and nobody won't do nothing against her. If she won't take the baby, what can I do?
The abandoned babies we saw on this particular day ranged in age from 6 weeks to about 3 months old. When you walk by their cribs, they try to make eye contact. If you pause for a moment and glance in their direction, they grin and giggle with delight until you turn away. I asked another social worker named Flory about each of the babies in this ward. She spoke with us through a translator.
What is the story of this little baby girl I'm holding in my arms? How old is she?
She is 3 months old.
Mama nu dorește să ia copilul acasă.
Her mom doesn't want to take her home because she doesn't have the conditions to raise her properly.
Mai are patru copii.
She has other four children.
Unul singur îl are în creștere.
And only one of them is raised by her.
What's the story of this little baby?
Peste 40 de ani.
His mom is over 40.
Este văduvă.
She's a widow.
De 10 ani.
For 10 years. Nobody from the family knew about the pregnancy.
Pierre Poupard is the head of UNICEF in Romania. He says poor mothers in other countries don't abandon their babies with such ease. Poupard blames the legacy of the communist era.
When we go back to the Ceausescu regime, the women were obliged to have children and to give them to the state. Probably created this kind of thinking that, yes, my baby can be taken care of by someone else. And what is important is for him or her to get food, to get a roof, and to get clothes. But the affection, but the bonding between the mother and the child, people don't understand in Romania in a way.
Dr. Adrian Toma, head of pediatrics at the Panay Serbu Hospital, says mothers who abandon their babies have perfected the art of detachment.
usually they come here knowing that, they're going to abandon the baby. So they usually play games with us. Like they don't want to see the baby. They don't come to breastfeed, not to get attached. They refuse to speak with a psychologist, and they usually leave the baby in the hospital.
The hospital staff has its hands full.
I notice there are many babies here left, and they're sucking bottles by themselves, and they're crying, and there are not enough people to help them. How do you take care of all these babies?
Hardly, but we do.
Hardly, but you do.
You know, you can see they are very nice and clean and
yeah, but they're happy. Not being, but they can't all be held.
Nice and clean and well-fed is what matters most in these hospitals, and that is a vast improvement from care during the communist era. But still, this is far different care from what you'd expect in American hospitals. We watched a nurse bathe this shivering 3-month-old in a large sink under cold tap water. When it's time to eat, the nurses just prop a bottle up on a pillow and turn the baby's head toward the nipple. UNICEF's Pierre Poupard says if Romanians don't start showing more concern over emotional bonding, a whole generation of children may grow up psychologically unstable.
It's disastrous, and this has been proven by many studies. This will not be shown probably in the first years. It will appear when the baby will be a young person and then young adults.
Government officials say the rate of child abandonment in Romania has dropped dramatically in the last decade. In fact, Theodora Bertzi, the government official who oversees child welfare, says the media exaggerates the problem.
They keep saying that there's an increased number of children abandoned in Romania, which is not the truth. The number of children abandoned decrease.
Not so, according to UNICEF's Pierre Poupard. His organization's study reveals the number of babies abandoned in maternity hospitals is the same as it was a decade ago, about 4,000 a year. That's 1 in 100 babies born in Romania.
It's clear it has not really improved. This has not really changed in the last 10, 15 years.
What has changed is where these babies end up once they're left behind. Next week, in part 2 of this series, we'll look at that issue as well as at a program that's helping new mothers bond with their babies. This story was produced by the World Vision Report's Christina Darden. The crisis in Kenya continues to shake that country. More than 1,000 people have suffered brutal deaths in the wake of the contested presidential election. From the Rift Valley, which has seen some of the worst violence, Richard Locke brings us this reporter's notebook.
It was a chilling sight. On one side of the road, a mob of several hundred youths. On the other side, the men, women, and children whose blood they were screaming for. They carried the crudest of weapons, but their intent was murderous. The mob was made up of President Kibaki's Kikuyu tribe, and they were guarding the entrance to their slum. The 300 or so people opposite them were Luos and supporters of Kenya's opposition. Keeping the two groups apart was a handful of armed police officers, whose air of control appeared little more than a bluff. Just 48 hours before, these Kikuyus and Luos had been living side by side as friends, just as they had done for years, even decades. Now the Luo were homeless. They'd been chased from their properties and forced to seek refuge on the grounds of a luxury lodge opposite the slum. One woman, who only wanted to give her name as Jane, was overcome with anxiety. "I left for work at the Rose Farm on Saturday morning," she told me. "By the time I finished my shift in the evening, our homes were burning." It was the following day when we spoke, and Jane still hadn't received news of her husband and two children. All she could do, she said, was pray they weren't among those who'd been burnt alive in their houses. Nearby, Eric Otieno huddled in a circle with his friends. Looking across the road at the mob, he said he was too nervous to talk into the microphone. "I know those people," he said incredulously. "We lived and worked together." He'd come to Naivasha 5 years ago in search of work on the flower farms. "Now they're telling us to go back home or they'll kill us," he said. For more than a month, intertribal violence has been tearing Kenya apart, as it seems. The fighting started in December, after the flawed presidential election, in which Mwai Kibaki was re-elected. Opposition supporters here in the Rift Valley, most of them from the Luo and Kalenjin tribes, vented their frustration on Kibaki's Kikuyu tribe, murdering hundreds. What I was witnessing now was the beginning of a dangerous cycle of reprisal attacks. "This is revenge," slurred Paul Machari, his breath heavy with the smell of liquor, the blade of his machete glinting in the sun. "They've beaten and killed our people. You give me a luo, and I'll skin him alive." I've been trying to work out what it is that turns friends into enemies, neighbors into killers, in just a matter of days. Perhaps I haven't been in East Africa long enough to understand the deep-seated animosities between tribes that usually simmer but remain buried beneath the surface. But many Kenyans are also asking the same questions. Nothing, no matter how deep the frustrations or great the sense of hopelessness, can explain the barbaric killing of friends and neighbors we've been witnessing.
Richard Locke is the World Vision Report's Africa correspondent. He's based in Nairobi. Dowdy Wera also lives in Nairobi. He runs an IT company, and on the side, he writes a blog. We checked in with him to find out the latest. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Dowdy, you've been in Nairobi watching all of this turmoil over the last 6 weeks, and many people thought it was going to die down after the elections, but that's not actually what's happening. Can you tell us what you're seeing on the ground there?
You're right, yes. The violence, the tension has moved on from being just a reaction to the election results. It's grown into something a lot bigger. We're seeing a lot of old tensions coming up. And there's a cycle of revenge and re-revenge. So that seems to be what has happened now. It's gone beyond the election.
Why is this spreading and not calming down, since political leaders are wrestling with this disputed election and trying to resolve things?
That's the million-dollar question. What is it that's sustaining the violence as well? And we've come to the point as Kenyans where we realize that there's a big conversation our country needs to have. There's a lot of historical injustices that were perpetrated immediately after the colonialists left. There's the legacy of colonialism. But beyond that, there's a lot of economic inequality in the country. And all these things, we have to sit down as Kenyans and have an honest conversation mm-hmm. with ourselves about the state of our country, because evidently not everything was as it seemed.
Mm-hmm. Because we've heard so much about just how stable a democracy Kenya has been. So this has surprised a lot of people. And I hear you saying that these tensions may have really just been under the surface, waiting for something like this to trigger it.
That's right. I don't want to downplay the causes that triggered these tensions. For example, there's the whole question of the legitimacy of the presidency. That is a key area that must be resolved before we even start really examining everything. Everything else is moot until that point. But there are some long-term historical tensions that also need to be addressed.
What is life like on the streets of downtown Nairobi? Are shops and businesses open as usual, or is business grinding to a halt?
Nairobi is a bit strange. Nairobi is almost like an oasis. Schools are running, shops are open, businesses are open. And then we go home in the evening and you watch TV and you see the violence going on in the other parts of the country, as much of the world is. But at the same time, especially in the lower income areas, there is a lot of tension and life hasn't gone back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say about the mood in Nairobi is that life is going on, but no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow. There's a lot of uncertainty in the air. What has changed in the last week or so is that finally it seems like the political leaders on both sides of the political divide finally seem to realize that the country was sliding down and things were getting completely out of control. So there's a sense of urgency now we're seeing amongst the political leaders that's matching the mood in the country. Everyone seems to realize that the next 2-3 weeks will be crucial,
mm-hmm.
be crucial for Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the political leadership, the African Union, as well as politicians from other African countries, have been trying to act as mediators for solving this election dispute. How well do you think that is working?
Yeah, it's been fantastic as a Kenyan to see mainly our African brothers and sisters coming and helping mediate in this. Now we have Kofi Annan leading the mediation. We had Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa here. What we're seeing is that the Kofi Annan-led initiative seems to be moving a lot faster. It seems to have direction. And it looks like the best bet that we have now for some political solution to all this. So it is making headway.
Dowdy, even if the politicians are able to solve the election dispute, which started all of this chaos, do you think it's possible now to put the cat back in the bag? I mean, will life return to normal after this is settled?
I really hope the cat doesn't just go back into the bag. I hope that we sit down and deal with these issues now. What we have to remember is that Kenya and Kenyan identity is a work in progress. We're building it as we go along. It's something that we all need to be involved in. The political solution is, it's a short-term gain, but it is, again, absolutely vital. The leadership at the top of the country has to be legitimate, and it has to be legitimate in the eyes of Kenyans. If we have a president whom half the country thinks is illegitimate, then everything else will just not happen. That's why it's so important that we have a political solution. That aside, again, we're seeing a lot of Kenyan society, especially civil society, have taken on the mantle of building the country back together again. So we're not just relying on the politicians. Every day we hear amazing stories of Kenyans across tribal, across economic, across racial, religious lines coming together, working for the country and saying, hey, we need to do this ourselves. There's the element of personal responsibility for our country that's coming back, and that's been seen a lot by Kenyans across the country.
Okay. All right. Dowdy Wera, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Dowdy Wera runs an IT company in Nairobi, Kenya. He also writes an online blog called Mental Acrobatics. And now, our Globe at a Glance. In Malawi, some civil servants are getting a pay raise, but it's not performance-related or based on merit. It's health-related. People with HIV who work for the civil service will get an extra $35 a month. The money is being given to help them buy more food. They don't need it for treatment. That's free in Malawi. But they do need good nutrition to help the drug therapy prolong their lives. And that's important because many African countries are losing skilled and experienced workers to AIDS. The economic fallout from that is a constant concern to governments struggling with the AIDS crisis. Some critics have suggested that giving people with AIDS a boost in income is like giving them a bonus or a reward for getting AIDS. The Malawian government counters that, saying a pay raise is a good thing because it will help sick workers return to health and to work quickly. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Mexico's tax revenue is only about 8 or 9% of its GDP, one of the lowest percentages in the world. That's because much of the country's economy is what is known as the informal economy, improvised markets and walking street vendors who earn small sums every day and are notoriously tricky to tax. Conrad Fox reports from Banderilla in southern Mexico on why street vendors can't or won't pay their taxes.
It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and business is already going well at the stall of Esteban Cortez. He sells an odd combination of sandals and hotcakes. Competition is stiff in the sandal business these days, with more and more people turning to street selling to make a living. So a few years back, he added a skillet and started selling the popular snack as well. He says it was hard to admit that footwear sales just weren't cutting it.
At first I felt kind of embarrassed. It's like you've stepped down in the world, you know? Your clients laugh at you, your friends, your family, but then they see it's a good business. Well, now, embarrassed? Me? They all want my recipe.
There's something else he's not embarrassed about either.
I'm a tax evader. I've never paid and I never intend to.
And neither do most of the estimated 20 million other street vendors in Mexico. Jorge Smecki is a professor of business administration at Mexico City's Iberoamericana University. He says street vendors like this one have been a blessing and a curse for Mexico.
The informal economy is like a social shock absorber, because the formal economy doesn't create enough new jobs every year. But the problem is, it's not taxed. There's no system. A typical market is 500 stalls, and they're not always the same. How do you know who's there? You've got the famous bullfighters, they're called. They lay out their products on a cloth on the ground. When the inspector comes, they just whip up the cloth like a matador and run away.
And that, he says, means about $3 billion in lost tax revenue for the country.
The truth is, very few Mexicans are paying taxes. It makes the country unsustainable. There's no way 30% of us can pay for the other 70%.
Today, some 40% of the country's tax revenue comes from the state-owned oil company. But many analysts predict Mexico's oil and the taxes that go with it could run out in just 10 years. That has politicians scrambling to tax street sellers. 2 years ago, they implemented a simplified version of the country's tax system for small business people like street vendors, charging a flat fee of about $22 every 2 months. But Esteban Cortez, the vendor who sells hotcakes, says even that is too much.
No recibimos ningún beneficio.
We don't get anything for it in return. We've got no place to sell, no social security. Sure, taxes pay for stuff like hospitals, but have an accident and see how much they charge you for an operation.
Doña Jolie earns about $400 a month selling food at the same market as Cortez. She says that when a family member gets sick, she has to go from stall to stall asking for help.
It's in God's hands. What the other sellers will chip in is all you've got.
She says she does pay her taxes, but only grudgingly.
It's not fair. I've got to pay property tax, electricity, water. I come here in a taxi, and imagine how much is left for me in the end. Nothing.
Mexico's president, Felipe Calderón, has vowed to find a way to make street vendors pay taxes. But Cortez says it'll have to be politicians that make the first move. They're so corrupt, he says. Why should I pay my taxes just so they can steal the money? For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Banderilla, Mexico.
As temperatures in New England dipped this winter, oil prices were climbing. Now many New Englanders are struggling to stay warm in their own homes. In Maine, more than 80% of households depend on oil for heat. Residents who never thought they'd need help now have to have it. But resources are few and far between. Patty White reports.
Now first of all, here's the thermostat.
67-year-old John Messines walks through the first floor of his house in the western mountains of Rumford, Maine.
Right now it's about 58, but you'll feel the difference once you get midway, mid-hall here.
As he enters the bedroom, Messines says he and his wife struggle to keep the house warm.
At night, I would imagine it gets in the low 40s in here, and that's ridiculous. Why should someone have to live like that in their own house?
The couple heats with oil, and prices are topping $3 a gallon. That translates into almost $800 for just one tank fill. Prices like that are out of reach for the Messineses. They're retired and on a fixed income. Going back to work isn't an option. John is disabled, and his wife Charlene is recovering from cancer. So they keep their thermostat low, sometimes as low as 50 degrees. Charlene Messines says their saving grace is a wood stove that roars in their living room. On really cold nights, she says they abandon their bedroom to sleep in front of it.
The last couple of nights, it's been a problem. It's been really, really cold to keep it warm. I mean, you just can't get warm.
Across the state, residents are doing all kinds of things to make do. Things like sealing windows with duct tape, sleeping in winter jackets, and using ovens for heat. And while the Messineses are struggling on a fixed income, even working families are finding it difficult to afford heating oil. Yvette Bouchard and Eric Mickelson own a picture framing business in Waldoboro, Maine. A few months ago, their oil tank hit empty. They had no oil for 10 days until they got enough aid to fill their tank partway. Bouchard says a cold house isn't the worst part of it.
It's the stress of not wanting the pipes to freeze and, you know, your house to be totally ruined. It's just that horrible feeling that the day might come when there isn't any help, and there you are with a disaster, you know, about to occur.
Even though Bouchard is afraid of disaster, she still finds it hard to ask for help.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel that maybe I'd be judged, you know, as being some sort of less than person for being in this difficulty.
Hey, Kath, it's Debbie at Community Concepts.
Hi, how can I help you?
I need to do an emergency benefit for one of your customers.
Okay.
Community Concepts is one place where people go for help. The local nonprofit distributes money from LIHEAP. That stands for Low Income Housing Energy Assistance Program. It's funded with federal dollars, and Debbie Green manages the program for Community Concepts. By the beginning of January, it had already gotten more requests for help than the entire heating season last year. Green says they get over 100 calls a day.
It is nonstop pretty much every day that we're here 5 days a week. It's very much nonstop.
People that have never needed fuel assistance before are now asking for help. But Green says just as residents can't keep up with oil prices, neither can LIHEAP.
Fuel prices are astronomical. The money's obviously not going as far.
5 years ago, the LIHEAP benefit would fill a tank and then some. But this year, the average benefit of $500 isn't enough to fill even one oil tank. You quickly get a sense of just how bad the problem is as you sit in Green's office.
Emergency line. You have 3 new messages.
As she checks her voicemail, Green finds a message from a woman whose oil tank is on empty.
Can't do a thing. She's already used her emergency money and her fuel benefit. It was a total of $825 for that household, and it's gone. Now I get to call and tell her.
The lack of adequate aid is so severe that Congress has approved extra funding for LIHEAP. Maine asked for $25 million of those dollars, but only got $8 million. With such a shortfall, it will still leave many to face the situation of the woman whose benefits have been used up.
Hi.
Hi, I got your message. Unfortunately, we've used all of the money that we had available for you. My next question is, have you done an application with Citizens Energy yet?
No.
Okay, that's 100 gallons.
Many residents will have to search for additional but limited help from a patchwork of local and state emergency funds.
If you get into an emergency situation, my suggestion would be the only other option I can think of would be try the city and see if there's anything they can do to help.
Until the money in the LIHEAP fund actually matches the reality of oil prices, it looks like conversations like this one will continue to happen for some time to come. For the World Vision Report, I'm Patty White in Auburn, Maine.
And it is an application process. It's not something that happens overnight, but at least you can get that started, and if you're eligible for them, that would be another.
And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can always hear us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast there if you want to listen on your MP3 player. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Christina Darden, and Lita Hartman. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.